Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. A little bit later, we'll get a report from some young gentlemen who spent some time in the Gulag County, in the Harris County Jail. But first up, let's hear from the author of the new book, Busted. Mr. Chris Fabricant. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Dean. Thanks very much for having me. And as you're educating, as am I, to keep people out of jail and to know their rights.
Exactly, sir. And before we get into the book, let's talk about your credentials and the work you do.
Right. I'm a criminal defense attorney, a public defender here in New York City. I have a broad variety of clients, but I do a lot of drug cases, and in particular, I have a few clients that I'm attempting to get resentenced under the notorious Rockefeller drug law that given life sentences to people for relatively minor criminal offenses and for first offenses. So that's the focus of my practice, and my book is also based on, or was inspired by, the many people that I've met over the years who call me when they get busted for minor drug possession cases and for driving while under the influence, and, you know, they don't really understand what the criminal justice system is really like until it's far too late. And so I thought that it was good to have some drug bust education before people get busted, because the criminal justice system brings nothing but pain and suffering, and people don't think that it can happen to them. But it can, and it does, to minor possession of marijuana included, you know, so it's good. It's good information to have.
Well, Chris, the way I read the book, and it is, it's a very in-depth look at a lifestyle, if you will. And
right.
Just little nuances that one can make to that lifestyle and in educating oneself to really make a difference.
Yeah, I try to in writing Busted, envision any scenario basically that a casual drug user, particularly a marijuana user, could find themselves in, you know, at a party or in a car, or somebody asks you or you ask somebody else to get you some marijuana, you know, what's the criminal liability behind that, and, you know, and what kind of risks are you really facing, and what will happen to you if you get caught, and how you can avoid this type of situation. And so, you know, that's what the book is aimed at, people who are, you know, that either partake or know people who partake, or people who are interested in how the criminal justice system really is. I've seen it from both sides, and, you know, that's what the book is for. So your drug war survival skills.
Well, as I understand it, the number one thing to do is learn how to handle a traffic stop. Would that be a fair assumption?
Well, the number one thing I would say to do is to not get either in your car with drugs in the car or drive under any kind of influence. Because I try to provide some tips on how to handle a police encounter on the road and also on the street. And there are some basic things that you can do that will basically give your defense attorney something to work with, you know, and some tips on how to make the situation not any worse than it already is. But fundamentally, I always say that I tell my readers to get wasted at home and stay home when you're wasted. That's the best advice I can give you.
This book, again, Busted, the Drug War Survival Skills. From the buy to the bust to begging for mercy. Let's talk about this final thought here, to begging for mercy. How
right.
To go about the after effects of a bust.
Right. Well, the book itself is designed kind of similar to an episode of Law and Order, in that it starts the beginning of drug possession through the Fourth Amendment, through the arrest process, and the trial process, and then begging for mercy, which is either pleading guilty or being sentenced. And the point in the begging for mercy section is deals with mandatory minimums, and people associate mandatory minimums with you know, like the Rockefeller drug laws, but there are mandatory minimums for the most minor drug possession cases, and those are designed to force you to plead guilty, to make you beg for mercy, because there's no way that you would risk going to a trial. And if you're caught for, you know, a relatively minor amount of marijuana, for instance, if you go to trial, you know, you could end up spending 6 months in jail. Whereas you plead guilty, the chances are good that you won't spend any more time in jail than you already spent. So really, the criminal justice system, once you've slipped down the black hole, it's very hard to get yourself out of without just simply pleading guilty and begging for mercy.
According to your book, perhaps 95% of these cases are pleaded out, never even really go to trial.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if it was more than 95%. The way that the drug war is set up and the way the criminal justice system is set up is that you essentially denied any right that you would have to a trial, because for a couple of different reasons. One is mandatory minimums, and number two is that suppression hearings are essentially trials in a drug possession bust. And that the suppression hearings where the judge, not the jury, decides whether or not the cop searched you illegally. And once the judge decides the cop did not search you illegally, which inevitably and invariably they will, even if the search was in fact illegal, there's no point in having a trial because, you know, you had the drugs, you know, and it's hard to find a defense for that. And so, you know, it's unique to the drug war in the sense that there's really no way that you can explain it away. You know, you can't use an alibi defense or try to blame it on somebody else or claim that it wasn't drugs. Or there aren't the traditional defenses are not available. So you're just stuck and you have to plead guilty. And, you know, it's unique to drug users in that sense. Drug dealers go to trial because there's so much more at stake and there are a few more defenses available to a drug dealer, but a casual drug user really has no chance in the criminal justice system.
And here again, sometimes it has to do with being able to afford higher-priced teams of attorneys. Somebody who comes to mind, Rush Limbaugh, for instance.
Right. I devoted a chapter on fighting your drug bust like Rush Limbaugh because I thought that he made a good drug war hero to all of us. That took a lot of pleasure in his drug bust, like I did, and most of the people that I associate with did. But it occurred to me that we all learn a lot from the way that Rush, you know, the way he scored his drugs, the way he fought his charges, the way that the type of attorney he hired, and what you really get for your money, and how Rush's spending the money is going to help him in the end. And sometimes people just assume that you can buy your way out of the criminal justice system, and sometimes that's true, but I thought it would be interesting to take a look at really what you get for your money. Limbaugh lesson number one is to choose your dope wisely, and Rush definitely, you know, followed his own advice there and wisely chose pills, which are the white-collar crime of the drug war, and they're always treated much less harshly than users of other narcotics, despite them being, you know, just as destructive and addictive. And so Russ has a much better chance of getting a better deal.
We're speaking with Chris Fabricant, the author of Busted, Drug War Survival Skills. It's just released by Harper Press. Chris, I live in Gulag City here, Houston, Texas. We send more people to prison for minor amounts of drugs than any place on earth.
I know you do.
Give my listeners some advice.
The best advice that I can give you is, well, I have 10 commandments. In Busted, and the first one, of course, is thou shalt not deal, and the second one is thou shalt not do dope with kitties. Now, those two things that you got to make sure that you never violate those two commandments. And the other thing is stay at home. Most people get busted, you know, on the street or outside concerts or outside bars or in their car or making a lot of noise at a loud house party. If you're going to indulge and you're going to roll the dice, you got to keep it discreet, and always lawyer up and keep your mouth shut. Those you follow those rules and you have a good chance of surviving the drug war. So you got to keep it discreet and you got to keep it away from the kids.
Well, I see that the latest catchphrase being put forth by the government is go ahead and be a hypocrite, lie to your kids.
Right.
And it seems to have worked so well at the authoritative level for them. Makes you wonder, doesn't it?
It does indeed, right? What do you suppose George Bush said to his kids? when he was out being a hypocrite. You know, that's it's really neither here nor there as far as what the government says. You know, what the criminal justice system will do is treat you rough. The stern warnings and the hypocrisy from the federal government itself is another matter.
Do you have a website going?
Yes, www.drugwarsurvival.com. And on drugwarsurvival.com, I answer questions that readers have about, you know, they're worried about getting busted, or I got one the other day about somebody who was going to order some mushrooms from Amsterdam, and people that are concerned about taking drug tests and that kind of thing. And so I'm trying to collect a user's database so they can, you know, be informed about what their rights are and what the drug war is like and what's happening out there on the drug war battlefield.
Once again, I can't recommend this book enough. The fact is, my friends, each year in America, 1.6 million people get arrested for drugs. You don't have to be part of that number. And no, I want to thank you for joining us, Chris.
Thanks very much, Dean. It's great to be here.
The Justice Department released its new national survey of jail inmates recently. They report there were nearly 445,000 convicted jail inmates in the U.S. in 2002 when the survey was conducted. It was estimated that one-third were under the influence of alcohol at the time of their offense, while 29% were under the influence of drugs. All told, about half were under the influence of either alcohol or drugs when they committed their crimes. Use figures are similar for state prisons. The Justice Department's last prison survey in 1997 showed that a little more than half of state prisoners and a third of federal prison inmates were under the influence of alcohol or drugs at the time of their offenses. Researchers at the Department's Bureau of Justice Statistics told me recently that a new prison survey is near completion and should be released by the end of this year. These drug-using inmates were convicted on a wide range of offenses. Drug offenders were more likely than any other inmates to have been drug users, though only 43% of drug offenders in jail, 42% of those in state prison, and 25% of those in federal prison were on drugs at the time of their offenses. A look at another set of data reveals a startling lesson. The FBI's Uniform Crime Report shows that for years now, law enforcement has been unable to find an offender on whom to pin the blame for more than 80% of all property crimes, more than half of all violent crimes, and, well, most drug crimes. The lesson? If you're going to do crimes, don't drink or use other drugs, because they make you easier to catch. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, Director of Research at Common Sense for Drug Policy.
I have to back up Doug's statement there. Back in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, I was busted 13 times. 11 times for being drunk with drugs in my pocket.
Did you know that in 11 states, the police have the right to drug test motorists if they've been involved in an accident? This is a good thing. We don't want people driving under the influence of mind-altering narcotics and crashing into school buses, do we? Of course we don't. The problem with drug testing motorists is that you have to collect blood and urine samples, and unlike the breathalyzer, test results are not immediate. But a solution has presented itself. A drug test industry has developed a new saliva test kit, which would work by swabbing the motorist's mouth for saliva and instantly analyzing it for drugs. Dr. Michael Walsh, president of the Walsh Group, which conducts research in substance abuse policy and technology development, and a former associate director to the Drug Czar, is pressuring Congress to pass legislation that would rid the streets of drug drivers by extending workplace drug regulations to all U.S. licensed drivers. The combination of this legislation and the saliva test kits will give law enforcement an essential tool to fight the war on drugs and will be a devastating blow to the underground drug society. Where will you go when you have no place to hide? This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
Stand, 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 stand.
Or forever
kneel, 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 kneel.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. Nausea, vomiting, breast symptoms to include pain, tenderness and engorgement, headache, emotional lability, upper respiratory infection, menstrual cramps, blood clots, stroke, and heart attacks. Time's up. The answer, Orthoevra for birth control. Approved by the FDA. The city of Houston, the county, Harris County, is once again proving itself to be the gulag filling station of planet Earth. Last week, the Houston Chronicle came out with another story that indicated a computer error had missed 400 to 600 more Harris County inmates that were sleeping on the floor. In that regard, I got the chance to speak to two young men aged 20 and 21, busted on misdemeanor charges, who were hauled down to the Harris County Jail. The Texas Commission on Jail Standards found the jail in non-compliance last June, estimating that overcrowding had left nearly 1,300 inmates sleeping on mattresses on the floor. Actually, the number sleeping on mattresses at the time of the report was closer to 1,700 to 1,900, so said Terry Julian, executive director of the Texas Commission on Jail Standards. But according to my interview of these two young gentlemen, that is not correct at all.
As far as that goes, there's no mattress or anything of that sort at all. I mean, it's just sleeping on straight concrete. I mean, there's no pillows, there's no blankets, there's nothing. And unless you're wearing white, you don't get to keep your clothes at all. And you're wearing anything that they give you that you don't know where it came from. Using toilet paper rolls as a pillow, taking off your shoe, using it as a pillow, filling up a sandwich bag that you got your sandwich in, you fill it up with water from the back of the toilet to drink. You don't know from tank to tank whether it's going to be hot, whether it's going to be cold. You're going to be sweating, you're going to be freezing, and there's whether you're uncomfortable to all's hell consent, you can't do anything about it. You just have to deal with it. You have to sit there. I mean, I came out physically bruised up from sitting on the concrete for so long and sleeping on the concrete. I gave away half my portions of food just to have a place to sleep on that dirty concrete, and it's horrible situation.
This is the other young gentleman busted for a misdemeanor charge and hauled to jail. What kind of food did they give you?
They gave me a bologna sandwich and some peanut butter and jelly cracker sandwiches.
And again, sir, were there people sleeping on mattresses on the floor, or were there even in mattresses there?
There were no mattresses. There was no place to sleep except the floor that had blood on it, feces, everything, urine, and vomit from all the alcoholics. And it was just a very dehumanizing process for me.
Houston already leads the world in the incarceration rate of its own people. But once again, according to the Chronicle, quote, the county will be able to open up more space for the burgeoning jail population, which a state official said is growing at a rate of 100 per month. All right, once again to misdemeanor arrestee number two. I want to ask, do they have separate facilities for you younger folks there on misdemeanors, or is there mixture with the rapists and murderers?
There is no boundary of what misdemeanor or what felony you committed. You're all in the same tank. And I was stuck in there with murderers and rapists, and it was just scary, you know?
How about you, number one?
Oh, I was in there with a young Mexican guy who had raped his 3-year-old daughter. I mean, and I was in there for a small marijuana charge, and it doesn't seem right for a Class C misdemeanor to be locked up with a felon.
Can you estimate how many people were in there with you on similar misdemeanor charges?
To be honest with you, I tried not to talk to that many people, because most people in there, if you looked at them, they would try and start something with you, but I'm estimating at least 85% or more.
How about you, sir?
Oh, yeah, it's a lot of bull crap in there. I didn't talk to very many people with considerable charges at all. Most of them were in there on technicalities, and it seemed like they were just taking up space.
Are all the guards in there bilingual? How does that situation develop?
Oh, no, they don't speak. Most of them are not bilingual at all. For instance, whenever I got discharged, I was leaving jail. I was in the last tank, and the commanding officer, kept making fun of this Mexican because he didn't speak English, and he was saying, pretty much calling him names and stuff right in front of him because he didn't know what he was saying. And just because he didn't speak that language, he was taking a fall for it. Another time in there was a Mexican guy that he didn't speak any English at all. And when you're in the tank, everybody has to be sitting down unless you're behind the wall where the toilets are. You have to be on the ground. And he didn't understand what the officer was saying, so he got slammed up against the concrete wall. And after that, he couldn't stand back up. He was half out on the ground, half passed out.
I want to back up a second here. I spent some time in the county jail back a few decades ago, and at that time they kept one tin cup in the each cell to drink with. But you're saying they don't even do that anymore? You have to drink from a plastic bag?
It's actually out of the back of the toilet you have to drink, like a dog. And most of the time there's urine and, you name it, throw up. And you have to drink out of it. And that's the only source of water you have.
I've heard that staph infections are running rampant at the Harris County Jail. Were the people being tended to?
There were certain instances where, I was in a tank with an old homeless man. He slept most of the time that he was in there, but at one point in time, he actually crapped his pants, sleeping 6 inches away from somebody on each side of him. Nobody cared. Nobody did anything about it. He wasn't cleaned up. He wasn't taken out of the tank, and everybody had to sleep on the floor with that.
How about you, sir?
Well, whenever I was going into the first tank, when I first got there, we were all forced to take off our shirts and get searched, and the man standing next to my friend here, he had ringworms very bad, and it was everywhere.
The man standing next to me when we first got searched, when we first got there, he was a quite a large Mexican man, but he had a serious skin infection. It looked like ringworm. The guard said it might be ringworm, but his skin was dry, flaking off, discolored. It was horrible. It was very bad.
All right, you gentlemen know that today's show is about getting busted. And about what you should or shouldn't do at the time the cop pulls you over. You first, sir, what have you learned?
Don't say anything to the cops that you aren't required to say. And on top of that, never submit to any search or seizure, and protect your Fourth Amendment rights.
And you, sir?
Pretty much, just don't be out in the middle of the night being stupid. I mean, that's the perfect time. That's what they're waiting for. They're waiting to catch you. And all they're worried about is making money on your mess-up, your screw-ups. And avoid it at all costs.
They're waiting for you. They're setting the trap, as you say. For youngsters out at night, it enhances the bank account of the bail bondsman, the lawyers, the county, and the cops look good because they got another mark on their record.
I think the worst part about it is that I have to pay them for me to go through this process, and it just seems like a double negative. There's no positive.
It was all over a stupid traffic violation, and it seems very, very unnecessary. I don't understand why we can do this to our own people. It doesn't make sense.
Speaking about a policy that doesn't make sense, Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
U.S.-occupied Afghanistan's pink poppies yield snow-white mountains of pitch-black market heroin. Since the fall of the Taliban in 2001, Afghan opium production has increased from 185 to nearly 5,000 tons. Opium production is the financial engine of American occupation, providing Afghanistan with two-thirds of its economy. U.S.-sponsored Afghan government officials are inextricably linked with the illegal trade, responsible for nearly 90% of world heroin supply. This week, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reports that regionally, heroin-related fatal overdoses among young people have tripled during the Bush presidency. In Scotland, the government has felt compelled to issue a series of TV ads warning young people about the dangers of chasing the dragon or smoking heroin in response to unprecedented purity and availability. Afghan drug czar Habibullah Kadari has announced that this year's opium harvest is once again set to increase. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
Mark Emery, the publisher of Cannabis Culture magazine and the producer of Pot TV, was arrested by Canadian authorities subservient to the wishes of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. It seems Mr. Emery had sold untold numbers of seeds to Americans. Following his release on bond, Mr. Emery appeared on the Canadian broadcast of Talk Back.
I'm totally proud of all the actions I have taken to liberate people worldwide, and if that means that one day I go to a U.S. hellhole for the rest of my life, that's something I have to accept, that this is the consequence of advocating peace and honor and democracy for the world's oppressed peoples, and I am the worldwide recognized leader of the cannabis people of 150 to 200 million people, all of whom are in bondage and oppression everywhere in the world, and this is a unique destiny that I have brought upon myself, and I am proud to have that. Our police have been co-opted. Our politicians have been co-opted by a Goliath of a tyranny called the United States of America under the Bush administration. Our country is in great danger of surrendering its beautiful values of tolerance, of compassion, of reasonableness to a very unreasonable archipelago of gulags strung out across the United States, you know, with a terrible dominator complex that cruelly imprisons tens of thousands of people for marijuana every year for terms of 5, 10, 15, 20 years. These are beyond the pale. This is no more legitimate than people in the Republic of China getting imprisoned for life for practicing Falun Gong. I am the most recognized and well-known advocate for the civilization of our marijuana laws in the world, and I am targeted specifically because of that. The DEA has admitted that that is the purpose of this whole persecution. One day we will be liberated from our bondage and that this terrible pogrom against us will end. Ultimately, perhaps I will have to be sacrificed that, although I'd like to think that Canadians will come to my aid and rally to our cause and realize that our whole value system of being Canadian is at stake here, and it is the politicians, perhaps, and our courts may sacrifice those values to appease an evil, evil organization called the United States of America. So although I think of this as extraordinarily cruel to face a life imprisonment term for what I may have done, it is no different than what tens of thousands of Americans have to endure every year for the same thing, their belief in the marijuana plant as sacrament, as a plant of good, as a concept, an idea, and basically ideology of enlightenment. The U.S. administration is totally out to destroy us and our culture. And so really, no sacrifice is too great to stand up to that.
To learn more, please visit CannabisCulture.com. Here in a couple of weeks, we'll be reporting from the methamphetamine conference to be held in Salt Lake City. But in the interim, I want to read you some extracts from a story published in the New York Times, written by Mr. John Tierney. Debunking the Drug War. America has a serious drug problem, but it's not the meth epidemic getting so much publicity. It's the problem identified by William Bennett, the former national drug czar and gambler. Quote, using drugs, he wrote, is wrong, not simply because drugs create medical problems. It is wrong because drugs destroy one's moral sense. People addicted to drugs neglect their duties, end quote. The problem afflicts a small minority of the people who have tried methamphetamines, but most of the law enforcement officials and politicians who lead the war against drugs. They're so consumed with drugs that they've lost sight of their duties. Like addicts, desperate for a high, they've declared meth the new crack, which was once called the new heroin. That title now belongs to OxyContin. With the help of the press, they're once again frightening the public with tales of a drug so seductive it instantly turns masses of upstanding citizens into addicts who ruin their health, their lives, and their families. The New York Times closes with this thought. Why spend three decades repeating the errors of prohibition for a drug that was never as dangerous as alcohol in the first place? Everybody gets it except those for whom the drug war means a mortgage payment. Be sure to join us next week on Cultural Baggage when we'll be reporting from the forthcoming Journey for Justice mass protest against mass incarceration on the White House. To learn more, visit journeyforjustice.org. Please visit drugtruth.net to learn more about our new program, Century of Lies. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Jap dancing on the edge of cannabis.